Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Late in the 8 o'clock hour of September 11th, 2001, on ABC's Good Morning America, hosts Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer updated their viewers on what had already happened.
We just got a report in that there's been some sort of explosion at the World Trade Center in New York City. One report said, and we can't confirm any of this, that a plane may have hit one of the two towers of the World Trade Center. But again, you're seeing the live pictures here.
As their TV cameras brought viewers live images, just minutes later, they checked in with a reporter on the scene who described the fire and smoke billowing from that first tower.
As fire crews are descending on this area, it does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
Oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
And within moments, the gravity of the situation started to sink in.
Oh, this is terrifying. Awful.
To watch powerless is a horror.
That fateful day, 18 years ago, four planes were commandeered by Al-Qaeda terrorists, used in a coordinated attack on New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania, killing 2,997 and changing the course of American history. In a new book, Boston journalist Mitchell Zukoff brings us back to that moment and masterfully pulls together the story of some of the remarkable people on that day, offering a minute-by-minute account of what happened. It's titled Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. Zukoff was a reporter at the Boston Globe on 9/11. He's now a professor of journalism at Boston University. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Kim.
Just preliminarily, I should note that your daughter, Eve, is one of our producers on the show, but she did not produce this segment.
And she would not share any questions with me, so her loyalties are clear.
Well, look, this is your book. You spent so much time with this. In some ways, hearing the tape of that day, and we all remember where we were, it brings it back like it was yesterday. But in some ways, it feels like it was so long ago. We don't even talk about Al-Qaeda that much anymore. Talk about that. Why did you write this book now?
You've put your finger right on it. It is both present for us and quite distant. And so we have an entire generation with no independent memories of those moments you just played. And we also have folks like us who were there, who remember it, and yet have, memories start to fade. And so we're at this kind of inflection point, I think, that we have to capture this now where we can still do it as news. Once it falls into the well of history, we can look back at it the way we do Pearl Harbor or Gettysburg or you name it. But it's still so present in our lives. We have 18-year-olds going off to fight in a war that started as a result of these attacks who had no independent memory of it. Mm. So to connect them to it was the idea behind the book.
And we're talking about remembering that day. Take us back there. What were you doing on that day?
Sure. I was actually not at the Globe. I was home on book leave trying to write my first book. And when the first plane went in, I was like most people. We were, we were naive. We were thinking, what kind of pilot could hit a twin tower on such a beautiful day and clear day? When the second plane went in, Flight 175, I rushed to the phone. It was ringing before I got there, and it was my editor telling me, your book leave is over. So I raced to the Globe, and very quickly it was established that I would be writing the lead news story for the day and taking feeds from several dozen of our colleagues who were everywhere at once, it felt like. It was an all-hands-on-deck moment. And so that became my responsibility that day.
And as you said, the narrative for the book began from the reporting for the Globe immediately after those attacks. We know that two of those four planes, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Flight 175, took off from Boston Logan Airport before hijacking and crashing into each of the Twin Towers. How did you capture the stories about how 9/11 affected affected the folks in and around Boston.
That was such an important element of that, Kim, because it was a local story as well as a historic story. We knew that these were our neighbors who were on those two planes. We had a colleague at the Boston Globe whose father was on Flight 11, as you know. And so, you know, we felt this responsibility and almost immediately, and this is one of the wonderful things I think about local journalism, we realized that we knew some of the people. We had connections. We were one degree apart from them. Caroline Louise Cole had written about John Oganowski, the pilot of Flight 11. Mm-hmm. She had been up on his farm talking about the work he had done with Cambodian refugees. Not that long before. So she could very quickly access those stories and the friends of his and the family members. So we were able to sort of sweep into the community that way. And the work I've done since is really piggybacking on those first days.
And you talk about the stories of the people. You talk about a host of people who had connections, particularly to these two flights, including the youngest victim of 9/11, two-year-old Christine Hansen, who was flying with her parents on what should have been a very joyous trip. Talk a little bit about her.
Sure. So Christine was the daughter of Peter and Sue Kim Hansen. They lived here in Massachusetts. They were flying out to Disneyland in California. Peter mm-hmm. was going to do some business out there. Sue Kim had was just about to get her PhD here at Boston University. This was just a beautiful young family. And when Flight 175 was hijacked, Peter Hansen was able to get a phone call off to Lee and Eunice Hansen, his parents in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And he told Dad, you know, tell the airline what's going on. We've been hijacked. And Lee Hansen called the local police department because he couldn't get the airline, and they told him, turn on the TV, Mr. Hansen. And so Lee and Eunice Hansen ended up watching the TV, and then Peter called back as they were watching, and Peter was actually comforting them, comforting his father, saying, Dad, don't worry, it'll be fast, even as he's comforting and huddling against Christine and Sue Kim. So I spent time with Lee and Eunice Hansen and in their home in Easton, Connecticut, in Peter's boyhood bedroom. And going back to your first question, you know, why now? Well, in the two or three years since I first met the Hansons, Lee has since passed away. Mm-hmm. So these stories, we need to catch them now.
And another story that you talk about, perhaps the last victim to learn about the attacks, is Elaine Dutch. She was severely burned, and she was in a coma for months afterwards.
Indeed. So Elaine was on the 88th floor of the North Tower. It was significant because she was the one who was about to that day get the documents to transfer the lease from the Twin Towers to private management. So this was a momentous day for the towers, and she was the recipient of these. So she stepped out into the hallway to get the messenger, and just then Flight 11 hits, a fireball comes down the elevator shaft and consumes her. And Elaine, by coincidence, I saw Elaine on Tuesday night.
Oh, wow.
And spent some time with her and her family. And Elaine heroically found a way to get down on her own two feet the entire 88 stories, but then, if you know about burns, at first you go into shock and the nerve endings are gone, but the pain comes later. And so, yes, she spent months in a coma, a medically induced coma, before she knew that the towers where she had worked for decades were gone. Friends were gone. It was she was in many ways for me a proxy for the confusion of all this.
So 9/11 is something that obviously has never left our consciousness, and you are writing about it in this really powerful way, telling these personal stories about the folks affected by it. I want to talk a little bit about how we talk about 9/11. Recently, Minnesota Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar came under fire for using the term, some people did something. She was making a broader point about how Muslims have been portrayed and treated in the United States since 9/11, but she came under criticism for diminishing what 9/11 was. What did you think of her comments, and what do you think more broadly about how we, moving forward, in history talk about 9/11.
Sure. Well, I think that any discussion of 9/11, particularly by public officials, should take pains to express reverence and respect for the victims, the survivors, and their families. And I think should make plain exactly who is responsible and should not glide past that. Now, of course, absolutely, we can also talk about and should talk about Islamophobia and unfortunate and wrongheaded efforts to equate American Muslims with Al-Qaeda. But I think we owe a responsibility to the people who were so deeply affected and to all of us to not glide past that. And in terms of how we talk about it, I think the, you know, maybe I'm an optimist, but I still believe we can get back to the unity that we had as a country immediately after. We understood that all Americans were attacked, regardless of race or creed or religion. Every imaginable kind of American was affected directly. If you look at the faces of the lost at the 9/11 memorial, you realize this is the mosaic of America. And we put aside petty politics. We put aside partisan sniping in the immediate aftermath. And what I would love to see is some memory of that.
So the story that you tell is also one of technology. It was just under 20 years ago, but we collectively watched these events unfold on our televisions. And we saw graphic images of what was ensuing. We watched the towers fall and how that affected everyone. And you also write about the communications of the folks on the planes were having with their loved ones through cell phones and their in-seat phones. Talk a little bit about the communication, how that is also another character in your book.
Very much so. It's so powerful. Well, the first real experience of that, I was down on Cape Cod talking with a woman named Julie Sweeney Roth, and her first husband, her husband, Brian Moose Sweeney, was on the second plane, and he left her a voicemail, and she played it for me. And she knew every word, every pause, every inflection. He was a former fighter pilot, a former Top Gun instructor, and he had left her this beautiful message. And so the technology is sort of preserved Brian's spirit that way. Mm-hmm. And then again and again, I was hearing these messages or I was hearing some version of them. And, you know, where the story really sort of coalesces is on Flight 93. Where all these people who are now hearing from their loved ones, hey, this is not isolated. You're the fourth plane at least that has been hijacked.
This is the plane that crashed into in Pennsylvania.
Precisely. And so they were the last one. And this was the group of 40 crew members and passengers who decided to do something. And one of the lesser known calls actually was between the mother-in-law of one of the passengers there and 911. She had called 911 for advice. And so that's an entire recorded call.
Wow.
And you have Joanne Makeley, you hear her saying to her daughter who's talking to her son-in-law on the plane, make him brave.
Hmm.
That was what your job is to do right now, she said to her daughter.
So this is obviously a fact-based account that is that builds upon or draws together a lot of in-depth reporting at the time as well as subsequently. But there's a lot of pseudoscience and conspiracy theories that are still prevalent 18 years later after 9/11. Having written about this, having done so much reporting, what do you think is the reason why some of these conspiracy theories have had legs and lasted this long?
I think whenever we have a major event, inevitably it feels as though there's some part of human nature that wants to come up with alternative explanations. And that is certainly true for 9/11. I've spent a lot of time reading a lot of these conspiracy theories. And frankly, it is the exact opposite of what we do. Exact opposite of journalism. They're starting with a conclusion and they're backfilling information, not facts, but information to fit that predetermined conclusion rather than starting with a question. What happened? Who did this? How did it happen? Why did the towers fall? And the result is, you know, if you do the work that we do, if you go after these theories, it ends up being like a game of whack-a-mole. You know, you knock one down and three more pop up. So the best we can do, I hope, and the reason why there are, you know, almost 1,000 citations of facts in my book, although I tell it as a narrative, the idea is if you want to know how do we know this? How do we know that this person said this? How do we know that the towers were built this way? Or what is the point at which structural steel loses its integrity? I can tell you. This is how I know that.
So you talk a lot about what happened during and after the attack. You don't talk a lot about what led to them, what failures or missed intelligence. Talk about your process and your approach a little bit.
Sure. You know, I'm vividly aware this is not the first book on 9/11. And I think some other writers and reporters have done extraordinarily good work on the lead up. You know, I say in the opening of the book, I bow to the work of Larry Wright in the looming tower, you know, who traces all the forces leading up to September 10th. And so one volume can only do something so well. And just as he stopped on September 10th, I picked up the story on September 10th. And of course, I make sweeping statements about the lead up and, the fatwa from Osama bin Laden. But that's a different volume.
Yeah. So if it seems, though, for those who remember 9/11, it serves as a dividing line in our recent history. There's pre-9/11 and post-9/11. We even talk about that, whether it's how we go through TSA or how other things have changed after that event. Do you think there's a need to sort of bridge that? I mean, is that division something that needs to be overcome, or do we need to keep that line very bright?
It's interesting. I'm not sure we do need to overcome it because we live – this is the water we swim in now. And you know, what happened before is a memory. And maybe for some of us it's a sweet memory. And certainly for a lot of the people who I wrote about, talking about September 10th was the hardest part of it for them because life was different for them. They were worried about, you know, who was going to get the dog to the vet kind of stuff. Mm. And then all this happened. But I think we are changed by this. We're changed as a culture. We're changed as individuals by it. And so I'm not sure there is any going back.
So the book begins with the fall, the attack, and what happened immediately after. And then there's a section, Rise from the Ashes, tying together the threads of the stories that you're telling of all these people throughout. And then you leave the story there. Why stop there?
Mm. You know, every story is kind of an organic being. And if, you know, it constantly changes and you have to make decisions about where to go. And again, I found that the Rise story, the story of the aftermath and pulling together the strands of what happened to these people, in many ways, the story, you know, it's not an easy story to tell. It's not an easy thing for them to experience. But there's moments of grace and there's moments of uplift that we were not defeated and they were not individually defeated. And we are stronger in the broken places. And that became the kind of driving force. And I, in a way, I couldn't wait to write the third part because I spent all these years living with the fall from the sky and the fall to the ground. And I knew there was something that comes after.
And what lessons do you think folks will take away from this book, or what do you hope that they take away from it?
I think there are two kinds of lessons, Kim. One is I want them to connect to the individuals. I want 9/11 not to be simply a math problem, if you will, where we know the number of people killed. And we know that there were 19 hijackers and 4 planes and the numbers of the planes. But when you connect to Elaine or you connect to Christine Hansen or you connect to the men of Ladder 6 or Colonel Wills crawling across a burning floor in the Pentagon with a woman on her back, You will never forget those people. So that's one lesson. And then the other lesson is kind of a bigger lesson, a more macro lesson for all of us and for our leaders, that we have to not be fighting the last wars. We have to make sure we're anticipating the possibilities of what comes next. You know, on 9/11, the reason why I delve into some of this, and this is the more investigative side of the book, you know, that we had 12 names on the FAA no-fly list and 60,000 names on the State Department tip-off list, but they weren't communicating with each other. The head of the FAA security didn't know the other list existed. They were worried about Russian bombers coming over the pole. So both the macro and the personal.
All right. Michael Zukoff is a professor of journalism at Boston University. Mitchell Zukoff, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. His latest book is Fall and Rise, the story of 9/11. He'll be at the Brookline Booksmith tonight. And there's more information about that on our website, radioboston.org. Mitchell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kim, so much.